This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
If you would like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
In Communications Engineering International, Kevin Rosario looks at rural solutions for regional telecoms development. Telephone densities in North America and Western Europe are approaching the one telephone per person mark in some countries. Compared to this, we have, in the continent of Africa, a density approaching 0.7 per 100 inhabitants. Naturally, this stark contrast is a cause for concern, especially when one considers that recent reports about the implementation of telecoms facilities all agree that such action results in many socio-economic benefits for the countries in question. In fact, the notion that the level of development of a country's telecoms setup is an indication of that country's economic prosperity is currently the vogue. The United Nations has made known its worries about the situation and, via the International Telecommunications Union, has staged a simple long-term aim for all telecommunications administrations to work towards. By the early part of next century, virtually the whole of mankind should be brought within easy reach of a telephone and, in due course, the other services telecommunications can provide. The practicalities of such an objective are, however, far from simple. The present population of Africa is about 542 million people, expected to double by the year 2000, with a current rural population of 389 million, of whom the majority have no access to even the most basic communications facilities. Likewise, the Asia-Pacific region, which constitutes 55% of the world's population, has only 17% of the world's telephones, and over 81% of these are concentrated in three countries, representing only 7% of the population. There is obviously a glaring imbalance and a potentially huge unsatisfied demand, which must be addressed. Problematic regions. It is the rural areas, which house the majority of the world's peoples, that have been neglected in telecommunications planning to date. Even in some remote parts of the United States, telephones are something alien to individual households, but communities such as these form only a tiny fraction of the population there. The trouble with rural areas is that they suffer poor geographic conditions, low income levels, low population densities, and underdeveloped social infrastructures, which create both technical and economic problems. Technical problems concern terrain, distance, and natural obstacles, requiring modes of transmission that are more adaptable than the standard copper wire used in urban areas. Economic problems involve the vast areas requiring coverage, which have only a small subscriber density. Thus, where will the profits come from becomes a burning question. From a strictly utilitarian viewpoint, rural installations will make a loss. Therefore, it's best to avoid them. On the other hand, it is beginning to be a well-established idea that telecoms speeds the development of a country's social and economic structure. So where the rural population is significant, it cannot be ignored. From a more altruistic and humanitarian viewpoint, the unbiased provision of communications should be a priority, no matter what the cost. In the long term, it can only benefit the regional community within a country and increase its rate of growth in line with urban sectors. It is really a case of qualitative benefits versus quantitative. If we look at developed countries, the major industrialised centres were the first to be provided with communications setups, and remote, non-important areas were left largely without. As urban areas became equipped to increasingly higher standards with profitable service provision, it was decided by the PTTs to look at the rest of their customers' needs. This is partly because costs balanced against their overall profitability were becoming cheaper, and partly because they are politically bound to provide a defined minimum level of service to rural districts. In non-developed countries, the same pattern has been emerging. Urban areas have had the greatest improvements to their telecommunications facilities, since this is where the administrations get their highest returns. In fact, figures show that while in industrialised countries, urban populations typically have 1.5 times the number of telephones as the rural populations, in developing countries, the figure is typically 10 times the number. But in countries where the rural population is very large, this pattern is potentially very damaging. The viewpoints above are therefore being slowly merged, and the realisation that communications in the rural environment can be a major channel of education, enhancing the local society and thus leading to future prosperity, is emerging. Overcoming distance and time considerations creates greater efficiency. PTTs who may have previously been shirking their responsibilities to remote areas are at last actively investigating cost-effective solutions to infrastructure provision in these parts, with an emphasis on flexibility, since such networks will be less well defined than their urban counterparts. Telecommunications companies have been quick to put on their consultant caps and give assurances that they can provide the perfect tailor-made solutions for each particular country's requirements. Just as in the not-so-long-ago days of colonialism, when developed countries decided it was time to, quote, develop the rest of the world, so now we witness the telecoms transnationals carving up lucrative third-world markets. And while it is accepted that communications contributes greatly to national development, overstatements, to the point of hyperbole, such as inaugurating rural telecom services will improve the standard of living and make social stability commonplace, made at Telecom 87's forum by Masami Kato, Deputy General Manager of Japan's NTT International Corporation, further indicate how companies are aggressively trying to open up the market. Defining rural. Rural areas are characterised by the fact that there is only a small number of telephone subscribers spread across a large region. Normally, a rural network is set up by extending the nearest existing telephone network into an unserviced part of a country. This involves special requirements. First and foremost, exchanges must be compatible with existing equipment, i.e., they must be capable of performing a number of conventional signalling procedures. Secondly, depending on geographical location, it must be possible to connect the subscriber to the exchange using a suitable transmission medium. And thirdly, where the power supply is non-existent or inadequate, alternatives must be available. New approaches. Traditionally, in the switching sector, computer-controlled services to remote communities were provided by slaving a small, unintelligent exchange over telephone circuits to the nearest large, intelligent facility. The advantages of this kind of setup were that overheads were kept low by sharing a central processor between several locations. However, there were drawbacks. The linking telephone circuits were vulnerable, and any damage would seriously affect rural exchange areas. Small standalone SPC exchanges are a much more viable alternative these days. Amongst the larger systems, we have AT&T's and Philips, PRX, Alcatel's Metaconta, Siemens Rural EWSD, and Ericsson's AXE, while for smaller scale installations, there is equipment such as the HDX10 from Hitachi, Teletra's DST1, and Telenorma's REX12, catering for a maximum of 12 lines. Some countries with heavy rural requirements have developed their own systems, such as Netas of Turkey with their Elif switch. With the dawn of digital telephone switching and recent advances in microelectronic design, namely large-scale integration, coupled with more favourable economics for computer intelligence and electronic storage, smaller digital exchanges are now viable for deployment in rural areas and are increasingly stealing the limelight. Northern Telecom's DMS 10M, GTE's REAX and Alcatel's E10s have all made inroads into rural telecoms provision, and further advanced models such as Nokia's modular DX200, which can accommodate between 200 and 40,000 subscribers, are proving popular. Furthermore, standard digital switches such as AXE, 5ESS/PRX, NEAX, EAX, System 12 and System X are all in theory adapted for use in rural areas. Mini AXE is a typical example. It has been designed to provide or update services in remote, sparsely populated regions in a cost-effective manner. An ideal environment, say its producers, is an extension to suburban exchanges for anything up to 2,048 lines. Transportability is also excellent, since an 896 line exchange, including all power and transmission equipment, will fit into a 10 cubic foot container. Adapting the PABX. A different option to provision of rural switching has been to modify existing PABXs for use in the public network. The advantage of this strategy is that the equipment is already mass-produced for the business communications market and can thus form the basis of very low-cost public facilities. Harris Corporation have done this with their Rex exchange, based upon the D1200 series PBX, and British Telecom, in cooperation with GEC Plessy, have similarly converted the Monarch PABX. The switch thus developed is called the UXD5 and is closely associated with the all-digital System X. It is a small-capacity exchange, tens of lines up to about 600, and ideal in low-traffic urban and rural areas. Its flexibility is such that it can be used standalone or fully integrated into an associated analog or digital network without changes to transmission plants or other exchanges. Remote control. The digital systems currently being adapted for remote use are also more suited for these environments in that they can be maintained via line testing and programming and administered from a remote terminal. Often forgotten is the fact that typically areas served by these exchanges have populations that are larger than urban areas in terms of traffic and exchange ratio. Therefore, continuity of operation is vital. To ensure this continuity, when faults are present, innovations such as duplication of vital system components, automatic fault detection routines, and rerouting are standard, while the incorporation of modularity provides for growth of the system with the community. For example, the rural version of EWSD from Siemens is structurally designed to upgrade or expand parts of the system wherever necessary, with facilities such as the coordination processor or line trunk groups, for instance. Varied applications are handled by creating individual EWSD exchanges containing only those system components essential to the application in question, with flexibility stemming from the use of functionally independent software and hardware units that communicate with each other via standardized independent interfaces. The exchange has a 50 to 7,500 subscriber capacity and consists of a single rack installation, making it a cost-effective and compact remote switch. From the Philips stable have come mobile versions of the PRX-A exchange, developed for switching 500 to 4,000 lines. Already over 100 have been shipped to India, Peru, Indonesia, Colombia, Suriname, Saudi Arabia, Egypt and the Netherlands. PRX-A lines in India total 99,000, with most exchanges, some 30-odd, existing in outlying regions of the country. From the exchange to the subscriber. It is usually the situation that anything up to three-quarters of the cost of installing a rural telecom system can be accounted for by transmission, and accordingly this has been an area of intense investigation. Cable is the standard carrier of signals in the urban and long-distance environments, having a long service life and, with suitable shielding, high immunity to message corruption, a factor very important for data communications. However, cable is difficult to install across many rural terrains, and cost considerations can suddenly become prohibitive. Remote installations therefore tend to be restricted to non-mountainous regions where population distribution is such that many telephone lines can gradually converge into trunk routes. Fibre optic cabling is one alternative. Although far more delicate than its copper counterpart and still much more expensive, it is smaller and lighter with greatly expanded traffic capacity, and requires less equipment to boost signal strength along the length of a link. This is really a medium of the future, and in Africa it has so far only been implemented in urban high-capacity routes. Most administrations are aware that one day all subscribers, urban and rural, will require high-capacity links for a host of telephone services such as fax transmission, data transmission, view data, cable television and video communications. There is an argument that says it will be more cost-effective in the long term to provide an integrated distribution medium now rather than individual systems as demand develops, especially as the price differential between cable and fibre is narrowing. However, defining long-term goals and achieving them are two very different things. Some observers might say that the idea of implementing fibre-optic cabling in rural areas in response to some future requirement from subscribers for data communications is a totally ridiculous one. Even in rural areas in industrialised nations, the need for fibre-optics for high-capacity data transmission remains doubtful. Radio choices. In the past, the choices in difficult terrain have really been open wire and radio. And, of the two, open wire has had the definite handicaps, in that while it is extremely cheap and easy to install, it has high continuing maintenance costs and inferior transmission performance. But, generally speaking, open wire systems are still useful, especially where existing open wire setups are in use. Radio, on the other hand, suffers from interference and can only utilise particular allocated frequencies in the spectrum. But it is often the only useful transmission medium in areas where topological factors make others ineffectual. Besides, it has ease of installation and maintenance on its side. Three types of connection are possible: dedicated channels where subscribers are awarded channels to themselves in a specified area, shared channels allowing access by several subscribers and involving a local manual exchange, and multi-access where a number of channels serve a large number of subscribers, on the assumption that it is unlikely that they will be communicating at the same time. All have drawbacks. Dedicated setups waste valuable segments of the frequency spectrum and incur large hardware costs per subscriber. Shared facilities usually entail extra manpower at the manual exchange and result in a lack of guaranteed privacy for callers. Multi-access may only prove beneficial in the short term, since communities could very quickly develop a taste for the new facilities, and to prevent the overloading of such a system, constant expansion would be required. Single-channel radio has been found to be an ideal solution for isolated subscribers, such as those on large remote farms. Concentrator and subscriber PCM systems are suited to places where demand for direct exchange lines is between 30 to 160, and therefore too small for a standalone exchange. Point-to-point and/or distributed 10 to 30 channel digital PCM is ideal in areas where electrified railway lines already exist. Continuing with rural solutions for regional telecoms development. Multi-access advantages. Most manufacturers have gone for the multiple access approach, and digital TDMA, time division multiple access, has proved popular. The simple reason for this is that these systems have been found to have unlimited penetration, short implementation time, and low maintenance costs. The only constraints have been the high initial costs and slow rate of automation of rural exchanges. SR Telecom have probably been the most successful manufacturer in this area, and their SR100 TDMA system has been a pioneer in point-to-multipoint communications. It is installed in 44 countries with 580 subscriber radio systems operating since 1977. The SR100 product has a capacity of up to 94 subscriber lines, served by 15 trunks, and provides services such as individual, two-party or multi-party lines, coin box stations, and data transmission up to 9,600 bodes per second. In one installation in the Gokwe and Mount Darwin regions of Zimbabwe, remote clinics, rural service centres, village police stations, missions and schools were connected where only a single central office exchange existed previously. The telephone service was extended by 20,000 kilometres in an area lacking any electrification, power or communications facilities by the installation of two SR-100 systems, supplemented with strategically placed SR repeaters using solar power. Over 300,000 people now have better communications in the region. SR Telecom also have the enhanced SR-500 system available. Using the same TDMA system as its predecessor, it can handle both voice and data circuits of various bit rates up to 64 kilobits per second, PCM voice trunks, or up to 1,200 2.4 kilobits per second data trunks. ANT offer a variety of rural transmission equipment. In the radio relay department, they have the microwave frequency, 14.5 to 15.35 gigahertz, DRS 2x2, which has a data transfer rate from 2 megabits per second to 8 megabits per second, which can be installed outdoors in weatherproof housing, and the FM72/400, which is specifically designed for analog solutions. It operates in the low frequency 225 to 420 MHz band and has capacities of 24, 60 and 72 telephone channels. The low frequency allows low directivity antenna usage, which in turn provides low-cost networks. TRT have amongst their offerings the long-established IRT-1500 microwave TDMA system, which operates in the 1.5 GHz band. Modularity enables the system to be used simply as a remote concentrator for a single terminal station or in any linear, star or tree network configuration using repeater stations. These can be located up to 50 kilometres apart, depending on propagation conditions, and low power consumption permits the use of solar power. TRT has over 300,000 kilometres of radio links operating in over 50 countries, covering both analogue and digital systems operating in the 1.5 to 23 gigahertz range. Seeking out cellular. With transmission providing the bulk of the financial burden to PTTs, usually because they have to install rather expensive cabled infrastructures before developing rural networks, cellular radio is becoming an attractive alternative proposition. Requiring no cabling, cellular offers a cheap and speedy means of setting up a rural communications facility without problems. In Malaysia, a cellular system called ATER has been in operation since the beginning of 1985, with a steady mobile subscriber growth rate to date. Soon after the system's inauguration, it was decided by the PTT to extend the mobile service and provide a telephone service to rural areas via coin collecting box public telephones. A special radio interface was developed by Ericsson for Malaysia, which makes it possible to connect the standard coin box telephone to the ATER network, eliminating the physical wire connection and making it ideal in hilly terrain where cable laying costs are prohibitive. Since then, about 500 coinbox interfaces have been supplied, and keen interest has been shown in the system by the administrations of Indonesia and New Zealand. Looking skyward. Of course, all the transmission media mentioned so far have been either landlines or land-based radio. But there is one more rapidly growing sector, satellite systems. Satellites have been providing communications for about 25 years, but their role has largely been to bring international communications to those who already have good local communications at hand. Only recently has it been envisaged that satcoms could be the ideal solution for linking domestic rural populations which may be spread out across large areas. Satellites can link multiple locations practically anywhere, regardless of the two debilitating factors which usually affect other transmission systems, topology and distance. Low traffic and long distance, in fact, are the perfect criteria for the assimilation of satellite systems into a rural network, particularly as high reliability, better than 99.9% for Intelsat, is guaranteed. So far, domestic telecommunications satellites' largest application has been for television programming. In the United States alone, there are over 1 million television receive-only, TVRO, stations in operation. Canada launched one of the first domestic systems in 1973. Owned and operated by Telesat Canada, the ANIC satellites that it uses have been used for linking some isolated northern communities to the terrestrial network, as well as for television distribution. In the early 1990s, Telesat aimed to launch a new system called MSAT, Mobile Satellite, which will further enable Canadians in the remotest parts of the country, including the north and the 200-mile offshore limit, to communicate directly by satellite with any other point in the country using small, inexpensive radio terminals. The system will help meet the growing demand in non-urban areas for voice and data communications to cars, aircraft, ships and other mobile operations, and will provide an equivalent to the cellular telephone service currently available. According to Telesat, MSAT will be a vehicle for the extension of the basic telephone service to households beyond the reach of today's land-based systems. It will consist of one operational Canadian satellite and one or two from the United States, and will utilize narrowband channels in the 800 and 1500 MHz bands. Satellite initiatives. Intelsat have been the organisation through which many countries have brought domestic communications to their rural communities. For example, the Brazilian system, SBTS, leases 7 transponders on Intelsat's 4A, F4, using a ground segment of 21 Earth stations. This brings vital telephony services to Amazonian territories, 59% of the country, which are often only accessible via the river system. To date, over 50 transponders have been leased to the Intelsat cooperative by around 30 nations, with domestic leases allocated at rates related to the state of the nation's infrastructure. However, some developing countries have embarked on their own satellite initiatives. Indonesia launched its Palapa domestic satellite communications system over 10 years ago, only the third country to do so after the United States and Canada. Today, over 190 Earth stations and 75 TVROs are installed, allowing 90% of Indonesia's 160 million population to be reached by television broadcasts. In the Palapa C generation, currently under development by the Indonesians and the French, 2 satellites will be added to the system, each with 24 transponders and intended to support the country's communications to at least the year 2005. In South Korea, Samsung Semiconductor and Telecommunications, Gold Star Electric, Daewoo Communications, Hyundai Electric and Oriental Precision are all in the process of negotiating a domestic system for the country. A tentative launch date for the 3 satellites in question, with a 500 to 1,000 watt capacity, is set at 1994. The estimated cost is put at $375 million. However, such systems are not always necessarily the most practical. While in Indonesia, SATCOMs may provide the perfect solution, since its landmass is fragmented into about 3,000 islands, and therefore distant multipoint links are crucial, other countries have different constraints. In Australia, although the continent is characterised by a harsh climate in its remote regions, the actual population without satisfactory communications facilities is thinly spread. Unlike Canada, where a single earth station can receive a community of a few hundred people, the requirement in Australia would be for earth stations serving single homesteads with a handful of services. In such a case, comparative costs of digital radio concentrator systems compared to satellite usage show that satellite technology implementation would cost almost double per customer connected. Australia Telecom have therefore gone with DRCS in their rural and remote areas programmes. A more promising role for satellite systems is emerging in Africa. Since the cost of communications via satellite is practically independent of terrestrial distance traversed, it is perfect for information dissemination in large and highly populated countries. African nations are presently conducting feasibility studies for the Regional African Satellite Communications, RASCOM, system. Commissioned by ministers of planning, transport and communications from all countries concerned, the studies will ascertain long-term telecommunications requirements in the continent, with special emphasis on rural areas, and will form part of a general move towards the formulation of an African Economic Community by 2000. The project is co-financed by the ITU, UNDP, UNESCO, West Germany and Italy, thereby creating a real partnership between industrialised countries and the developing world. Pooling resources. It seems that while efforts to divert telecommunications products in the direction of developing nations are on the increase, administrations in these countries are finding it difficult to implement solutions cheaply. In the words of S. Abdul Rahman, Director General of the Indonesian Post and Telecommunications Administration, industrialised countries do not have enough interest to develop or to assist us in developing what I call low-cost solutions for the developing world. Fostering cooperation between states, as exemplified by RASCOM, is probably going to be the most effective way of developing regional communications through reduced capital layouts and operating costs and pooled resources. Such a conclusion has been reached through the realisation that a self-help approach is likely to be the only way to proceed in view of most countries' lack of financial backup. And since rural areas are not known for economically viable telecommunications, such cooperation will probably be the most prudent course to follow.
Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven.
This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
With Trevor Brooke.
And Maggie Stevenson. A report by Matthew Bond for the Sunday Telegraph regarding TVAM. It is a continuing irritation to Bruce Gyngell, the Australian Managing Director of TVAM, that the first thing that drowsy prospective viewers of his channel have to do is reject the BBC. For it is a sad fact of commercial life that most British television sets, 72%, Gyngell accurately grumbles, tune automatically to BBC One when switched on. Difficult tasks like pressing two buttons should be kept to a minimum at this sensitive time of the morning, he believes. But recent thumping interim figures from the commercial television breakfast station, pre-tax profits up 56% to 7.8 million, advertising revenue up 20%, should have prompted a good few city viewers to reach for their sets. Those that did, he hopes, liked what they saw. For Gyngell, brought into the station in 1984 by its first Australian saviour, Kerry Packer, thinks the station is now very, very close to throwing off the last camera-quivering effects of the now infamous technician strike, the so-called dark days of TVAM. The plan is for things to be back to normal by 23rd of November, the anniversary of the date that Gyngell broke the mould of British television by sacking the station's 233 ACTT technicians. In this, he earned the undying gratitude of the Prime Minister. Now, providing the Independent Broadcasting Authority is happy with the station's recent improvements, Gyngell is confident it will be, he and his Camden Lock crew will be able to get on with planning for the future. In a move that shows that the 59-year-old Gyngell fully intends to be part of that future, he yesterday quietly joined the staff of TVAM. Before that, his services had become a courtesy of a subsidiary of Consolidated Press, a legacy from the Packer days. His domestic base is now also very much in Britain as a result of the extraordinary chemistry that pervades the Camden studios. His second wife, former TVAM presenter Cathy Rowan, presented him with his second child a fortnight ago. Of the medium-term future until franchises are abolished, TV companies have only medium-term futures, Gyngell is reluctant to be drawn ahead of the publication of the Broadcasting Bill later this autumn. For his first priority is that TVAM retains its franchise in 1992. If the much-awaited and much-anticipated bill reveals that franchises will be decided by a straight auction, then Gyngell will be happy to sit on and add to the £22 million cash pile that the company revealed last week. Diversification, if and when it comes, will be in the areas that Gyngell feels TVAM knows and enjoys. Not surprisingly, a station responsible for inflicting Roland Rat on an unsuspecting world is well aware of the potential that related products, annals, toys, videos, etc. offers. But a bigger push is likely to come in the supplying of news to the expanding TV sector and in information technology. The latter will draw particularly on the strengths acquired over the last few months as the station replaces its ACTT technicians with new technology operated by just 11 engineers and 70 young. Gyngell is a great believer in the positive qualities of youth, enthusiastic multifunctional operatives. Apparently, he is less of a believer in the English language. Indeed, some of the sacked technicians have been replaced by robots. The station is now equipping regional studios, which can be totally controlled, including the cameras, by a computer keyboard in London. Any move will reflect Zhinshul's huge wealth of experience in the industry, acquired with Packer in Australia, and in the middle 70s with Lou Grade's ATV, where he was deputy managing director. I have been in television for some 35 years, and I have seen more television people diversify into loss-making businesses than anything else. Zhinshul, who many feel did to television what Rupert Murdoch did to newspapers, feels that there are lessons to be learned from the expansion of Murdoch's media interests. If you look at Rupert, he has never really got out of the business he was first in, he says. TVAM's share register has a checkered history. It currently includes Alan Bond with 20%. He can only vote 10%. The Saudi-controlled Aitken Telecommunications with 9.9%, with no votes at all. Peter de Savary with 10%. The former Carlton executive Mike Luckwell with 5%, and George Soros's Quantum Fund with about 7%. The revelation that the Aitken stake was controlled by the Saudi Al-Bilad consortium almost cost TVAM its franchise and, after a heart attack, came close to costing Zhinshul his life. I couldn't believe we had got through 3 months of the strike to find all of a sudden our franchise was in jeopardy. Zhinshul is keen that nothing endangers that franchise again.
And now it's a million-selling single, Edifax.
Brown-Eyed Girl by Van Morrison, or sometimes known as Van the Man. Van Morrison was acknowledged as one of Britain's foremost blues whalers due to the influence of his father's big collection of blues records. He was born on the 31st of August, 1945, in Belfast. At the age of 11, he sang with a skiffle group at the local Palais de Danse, and in 1960, he went to Germany, playing at US bases for 4 months. On return to Belfast, he formed the group Them in 1964, which was signed to Decca, the recording company. Their first disc was released in September 1964. Their second disc broke the charts, Baby Please Don't Go, and their third, Here Comes the Night, was a worldwide hit. That was followed by TV, national tours, and much acclaim for Van and Them. Trouble over music policy caused the group to break up, and Van Morrison returned to Belfast from London and formed the new Them group. One of the group's discs, Gloria, was a hit in the USA in 1965, written by Van Morrison. Van was subsequently signed to an exclusive contract by Bang Records in New York, and Brown Eyed Girl was his first release in March 1967, a self-penned song. It got to number 7 in the US charts and spent 16 weeks totally in the American charts, with an eventual million sale. The song, Brown Eyed Girl, has a big beat and great vocal by Van with a chorus backing. Van writes much of his own material and made a tour of the USA following the success of Brown Eyed Girl. It was also released on the London record label in Britain on the 28th of July in 1967 and reissued again 6 years later in 1973.
Wall.
is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
The regulatory role of the IBA, a letter to The Independent from Richard Dunn, Managing Director of Thames Television. Dear Sir, part of the problem with the public debate about the future of broadcasting is the polarised terms in which it is conducted. It seems to me, and to my colleagues in ITV, that there may be some merit in the proposals of the Home Affairs Committee for one regulatory authority to supervise all non-BBC television services, ITV, Channel 4, BSB, cable programmes and so on. Indeed, this was the proposal made to the Home Affairs Committee by the Director General of the IBA, who argued for, quote, a single broadcasting regulatory authority for all television services other than those of the BBC. Naturally, Mr. Whitney believes the single new authority should be the IBA. Not unnaturally, the Cable Authority disagrees. When I gave evidence to the Home Affairs Committee on behalf of ITV, I said, quote, we would envisage the IBA remaining the regulatory authority because we see an important future for the public service broadcasting in the commercial sector throughout the 1990s. Having listened to all the evidence, the Home Affairs Committee produced an intelligent and comprehensive set of recommendations, including the establishment of a commercial television authority, quote, to act as the sole regulatory body for commercial television, however transmitted. In saying that we recognise the arguments in favour of such a proposal, I was saying that whereas we have previously tended to feel that different television services should have different regulatory keepers, the IBA and the Home Affairs Committee may be right that for the 90s, one authority would be best. If the IBA is to merge with certain parts of the Cable Authority, the new body will almost certainly, as with merging political parties, have to find a new name. Indeed, the IBA used to be the ITA before local radio was added to its television responsibilities. The Commercial Television Authority, recommended by the Home Affairs Committee, would not have a lighter touch, as your article stated, but would have a variety of different levels and standards of performance among the services regulated. The ITV companies have great regard for the IBA and the way it carries out the difficult tasks delegated to it by Parliament. My personal view is that the best way of achieving a single authority, if that is what the government wants, would be to appoint as successor to Lord Thompson, who retires at the end of this year, someone whose brief is to evolve the Independent Television Authority into a commercial television authority along the lines of the Home Affairs Committee proposal. That letter from Richard Dunn, Managing Director, Thames Television, London West 1, who is also chairman of the ITV Association.
And now the first of two reports on the subject of satellite broadcasting. This first piece was by Raymond Snoddy of the Financial Times, and it was entitled Ambitions to be the Best. The contest between British Satellite Broadcasting, Britain's £625 million direct broadcasting by satellite venture, and the ITV companies for the right to televise football has been tense, at times a little rough, and has just gone into extra time. BSB went into a dramatic lead in May when the satellite company, which plans to launch three new channels of television in the autumn of 1989, announced a plan for a joint venture with a football league and the Football Association, which would guarantee football a minimum of £9 million a year in television rights. ITV, as interested in stopping BSB as in how many live Saturday afternoon football games it could cover, struck back with an unilateral offer to top 10 First Division clubs, an offer that carried with it the danger of splitting the Football League. After BSB increased its minimum guarantee to £11 million a season and ITV put on the table a competing offer worth a total of £52 million over 4 years, the football authorities are jumping with joy at the effect competition between the new media and the old is having on the going rate for the game. For 30 years, we've got a pittance because they, the BBC and ITV, got together. We have another market now. We have BSB. Mr. Jack Dunnett, former president of the Football League, said quite recently, The winner of this particular match is still to be decided. The BSB often appeals to many clubs because it offers a long-term partnership to share all revenues flowing from the exploitation of UK football rights around the world and the potential for pay-per-view, the charging of subscribers to watch top individual matches. The First Division clubs have, however, decided to back ITV. The battle for football rights is just the most dramatic and public sign so far of the effect BSB could have on the traditional broadcasting environment in the United Kingdom. The satellite company plans to spend up to £120 million a year on its three channels. Now with sport, live events and 8 hours of news a day. Screen, the subscription film channel, and Galaxy, the family and general entertainment channel, and a range of shareholders which include the Bond Corporation of Australia, Reed International and Next, the retail group, to pay for the manufacture and launch of two high-power satellites and get the service underway. Later next year, BSB will go to the city to raise a further £400 million to complete the funding of the project. BSB says that everything is on schedule for the launch of the first satellite in August 1989 and of the television service before Christmas that year. In the battle against competitors such as Mr. Murdoch, BSB will have smaller dish aerials, 35 centimetres to 45 centimetres, compared with 60 centimetres to 75 centimetres, and a more sophisticated technical standard, DMAC, capable of carrying digital stereo sound and the eventual move towards higher definition television pictures. The company is clearly looking for the premium programmes that will persuade people to buy the special BSB receiving equipment and help to keep at bay Mr. Rupert Murdoch, who plans to launch four free channels on the Luxembourg satellite project Astra. "We are still the best show in town," says Mr. Anthony Simmons-Gooding, chief executive of BSB, a consortium the founder shareholders of which are Granada, Pearson, publishers of the Financial Times, Virgin and Anglia Television. Although it is taking its ambitions to be the best very seriously, BSB is clearly both a high cost and a high risk project, and Mr. Murdoch's plans should make Astra a far more formidable competitor than once seemed likely. Around £225 million has already been raised from the founders. The BSB's business plan, which envisages reaching 2.5 million homes by the third year, is firmly based on subscription revenue, particularly in the early years of the 15-year franchise, before advertising builds up. All BSB channels will be scrambled, and each subscriber will have his own personal identification number with a monthly charge of about £10 a month for screen, while the two other channels will be financed by advertising. "The plan is to offer at least one high-quality film a day that is different," said Mr. Andy Birchall, Managing Director of Screen. Mr. Birchall added that he had reached agreement with a number of film distributors to gain access to films 6 months after theatrical release. Mr. Gunnar Rugheimer, Managing Director of the Galaxy Channel, will have between £40 million to £50 million a year to spend on programmes. "At the upper end of that scale, I think it will be quite a respectable schedule. At the lower end, it will be a little bit tough, but it's not rubbish," said Mr. Rugheimer, a former senior BBC executive involved in the two previous failed attempts to get BBS off the ground in UK. "I always thought it could be done. We have now got the right skills together for the first time under one roof," added Mr. Rugheimer. BSB is studying a wide range of marketing promotional plans to get as many receivers to be produced exclusively by between three and five manufacturers for the first 3 years out onto the market as quickly as possible. One possibility is that subsidised receivers will be given to all those who pay a subscription in advance, perhaps for a year. Free receivers may be given to opinion formers, and another possibility is that, rather like the Channel Tunnel, shares will be offered to the public, accompanied by free initial subscriptions for those who buy the equipment. But in the face of the early competition from Mr. Murdoch, Mr. Simmons-Gooding is clear that the challenge now will be to persuade the consumer of the quality of the programmes BSB plans on offer, in order to stop people going for him and to wait for us.
Are you interested in improving AM reception? We are now producing a PhaseLock AM synchronous detector unit. There are four controls on the front panel: loop, wide, medium or narrow, allows use with unstable signals or transmitters carrying phase-modulated radio data. Next, a selector provides low distortion envelope detection, double sideband, lower sideband, upper sideband, independent sideband or stereo spread, giving intriguing effects with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, and quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and allows audio from any weaker co-channel station to be heard more clearly. The remaining two controls are center frequency and window on-off, which enables the unit to hold lock tenaciously, even under severe interference or complete fade-out. Apart from the well-known benefit of reducing the gross distortion of selective fading, synchronous detection also provides an improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. The remaining objectionable effect during a selective fade is the surging in audio level, as the receiver AGC unnecessarily increases the gain. So our unit also includes a broadcast quality multiple time constant audio limiter. The complete boxed unit costs £150, and a detailed information sheet is available if you send along 1 14-pence British stamp or 1 international reply coupon to Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And now the second article about satellite television. Barry Fox reports on the latest developments at Astra's Technology Centre in Electronic Times. Luxembourg's Astra satellite is due for launch in November, and the British BSB bird goes up into a different orbital slot in autumn 1989. But according to Marcus Bicknell, Astra's commercial director, there is not room for both Astra and BSB. It will be a great fight, and I relish it. The Astra Satellite Control Centre, where the fight begins, is in a castle that once belonged to the Grand Duke of Betzdorf in Luxembourg. The castle has been restored and converted into administrative offices. Close by, hidden in the vast wooded grounds, a high-technology centre controls 11 and 9.5-metre satellite dishes. Astra, with 50% of its $180 million investment guaranteed by the Luxembourg government, has been showing the command centre to television companies which are looking for a satellite to broadcast their wares. The high cost of sending television signals from London to Luxembourg will generally prohibit uplinking programmes from Betzdorf. The British television companies will uplink to the Astra satellite via British Telecom at Woolwich or Goonhilly. But the 9.5-metre dish can do the job if necessary. The 11-metre dish is the key to Astra's survival. It will control the satellite once it has been launched. Driving satellites round the sky has very little to do with looking at television pictures, explained Don Anglis, head of Astra's satellite engineering section. Anglis's job is to hold Astra's RCA General Electric satellite steady in orbit so that ground dishes receive a consistent signal. The practical difficulties only become apparent when you talk with someone at the sharp end. Astra has been allocated an orbital slot at 19.2 degrees east, and the bird must be kept within a box 36,000 kilometres out in space, which is just 75 metres wide. The Earth is not truly spherical, and there are mountains and seas which alter the pull of gravity. Add to this the pull of the Moon, and the satellite is continually trying to drift out of its box. A self-adjusting satellite costs too much, so the job is done from the ground. Heaters in the satellite vaporise hydrazine fuel, which puffs through jets to readjust the satellite's position. East-west adjustment is done once every 14 days, and north-south manoeuvring every 17 days. If the command station gets things right, the hydrazine fuel lasts 12 years. If a mistake wastes fuel, the satellite will become useless before its normal lifespan of 10 years. The last reserves of fuel must always be wasted on pushing the satellite just slightly out of circular geostationary orbit, and so make room for another craft to take over its job. The satellite then drifts for around 20,000 years before finally sinking so low that it burns up in the Earth's atmosphere. Astra's RCA Model 4000 satellite has 16 47-watt transmitters and six spares. Each is powered by a helical travelling wave tube made by Hughes. These TWTs have 30% efficiency, consuming 130 watts to deliver 47 watts. Their input power comes from solar panels, which can generate a total output of 3.6 kilowatts. So, although extra power is needed for manoeuvring, to heat the hydrazine, most of the time the solar array is underused. Some of its output is shunted to three nickel hydrogen batteries, each with 50 ampere hour storage capacity. These keep the satellite working during the 45-day eclipse periods in February-March and September-October, when the sun is shielded by the moon for up to 72 minutes. Surplus power from the panels can be shunted through a resistor and into space as heat, but ground control will usually turn the solar arrays slightly, so that they are only partly facing the sun. This not only limits power, but slows the natural degeneration of the arrays caused by the powerful ultraviolet light to which they are exposed. There is no way to repair a satellite in geostationary orbit, so if any vital component fails, the whole craft becomes useless. This is what happened last winter to the West German direct broadcasting satellite, TVSAT. One of the solar panels failed to open after launch. Not only was the craft starved of power, but the wrongly positioned panel blocked reception of television signals beamed up from the Earth. No one knows exactly what went wrong, whether it was a hardware or human fault. Sensors on board the Astra satellite will continually make 200 telemetry measurements every second and beam them back down to the control station. Adjustments can then be made from the ground, switching attenuators in or out to change filament voltages, for instance. Since November 1986, Betzdorf has been running simulations and developing procedures to correct every conceivable fault that is likely to set alarm bells ringing over the next 10 years. Operators work with two Hewlett-Packard A900 computers. One is always in the role of spare, and both can be overridden. Something as mundane as a power cut in the Betzdorf area could prove disastrous, so the control centre power supply floats on batteries, which can take over for 20 minutes, while one or two spare diesels is started. Astra is now negotiating for the purchase of a second satellite. This involves much more than raising the $50 million for the hardware, and the same again for the launch rocket. The transmitters on each satellite must be configured to give the reception footprint specified by the owner. It took RCA and General Electric 9 months to reconfigure the footprints so that Astra could cover most of Europe with signals strong enough for reception on a 60-centimeter dish. It takes 2 years to build a satellite from scratch. The Russians offer launch facilities, but all DBS and communications satellites use United States components, and there is a United States government ban on exports to the Soviet bloc. There is no ban on export to China, but the Chinese launch program is at the beginning of what could prove to be an expensive learning curve. Astra's engineers want to buy another RCA GE satellite because their control centre computers are already configured for the first. The Luxembourg government is insisting on priority to European manufacturers. Because uplink signals are susceptible to poor weather, heavy rain for instance, the RCA GE Bird has a driver limiter amplifier, DLA, ahead of each TWT. If the uplink power falls, the DLA cleans and boosts the signal before retransmission. Using DLAs is also an insurance policy against hijacking. TWTs are left switch on because they last longer, but DLAs can be switched off when a channel is not broadcasting. That way, hijackers cannot beam up their own signals for the satellite to retransmit. Any satellite operator's greatest fear is that somebody will hijack the telemetry link. In theory, they could fire a thruster and put it out of orbit. In practice, this is impossible because the telemetry command link is coded using the United States Data Encryption Standard. This uses a 54-bit code, which the smartest computer cannot crack in 10 years. In missile silo fashion, Astra changes the code every month by physical keying. Two metal keys held by two people must be turned in two locks at the same time. Anyone in the world who is trying to crack the DES code is then set back to square one. The only way in which hijackers can take over a satellite channel is to broadcast a stronger uplink signal. But they would need to outrank Astra's dish, which is transmitting SHF at up to 1 kilowatt in a pencil beam 0.02 degrees wide.
Following publication of a book entitled Ferranti and the British Electrical Industry by J.F. Wilson, a report by Geoffrey Owen in the Financial Times recently entitled The Italian Who Set British Sparks Flying. Why did Britain, having led the Industrial Revolution, fall behind the United States and Germany in the last quarter of the 19th century? Some historians blame the lag on entrepreneurial failure. Yet the career of Sebastian Ferranti, subject of an excellent study by J.F. Wilson, lends only partial support to this explanation. Here was a prolific inventor-entrepreneur who had a clear vision of the potential of electricity. But for all his achievements, his own company and his local rivals such as Brush, Crompton and Mather and Platt were far outpaced in size and rate of growth by General Electric and Westinghouse in the United States, Siemens and AEG in Germany. Ferranti, with his exotic Italian background, was hardly a typical Victorian industrialist, though he shared some of the weaknesses of his contemporaries, not least his reluctance to dilute personal control of the business. The consequent fragility in its financial structure, coupled with his fondness for continual technical experimentation, contributed to the collapse of the company in 1903. A.W. Tait, the receiver manager, who rebuilt Ferranti on more solid foundations, felt that the progress of British business over the past generation had been dogged by the curse of individualism. Tait was later one of the founders of the Business Parliament, the Federation of British Industries. Sebastian Ferranti was exceptional in his technical ingenuity and in the scale of his ambitions. In his early 20s, he was chief engineer at one of the first public electricity supply stations at Grosvenor Gallery in the West End of London. This was followed in 1888 to 1891 by the attempt to build the first modern power station at Deptford in East London. In size and technical complexity, the Deptford project was far ahead of anything that had been tried before, though the concept was partly modelled on the large centralised gasworks feeding consumers through an integrated piping network. The teething problems were formidable, and in the end the conflict between the owner's commercial needs and Sebastian Ferranti's engineering aspirations proved unbearable. Critics said Deptford was ahead of its time. It's true that Ferranti was sometimes carried away by his own technical virtuosity. But the problems which Ferranti and the other pioneers of the electrical industry faced lay at least as much in the nature of the market as in their own shortcomings. In the period from 1880 to 1920, when the Germans and Americans were gaining ground, demand for electric lighting in Britain was held back, partly by the entrenched position of a cheaper rival, gas, but also by the technical backwardness and small scale of the supply industry. The local electricity undertakings were limited by law in the areas which they could serve, while lack of design standardisation, reflecting the role of consulting engineers, kept costs unnecessarily high. Financiers were reluctant to invest in what was seen as a slow-growing, technically risky industry. These difficulties began to ease in the second phase of Ferranti's business career. After 10 years of virtual exile as a freelance engineer, he returned in 1914 to a stronger, better balanced company. By the 1920s, reforms in the structure of the electricity supply system, for which Ferranti had campaigned for many years, were set in train. With the creation of the Central Electricity Generating Board and the start of the national grid, the wider use of electrical lighting and the introduction of new products, such as radio, opportunities for electrical equipment makers were greatly enlarged. Ferranti's ability to persuade the CEB to adopt 132,000 volts as the transmission voltage and to use his design of three-phase transformer laid the basis for his company's strong international position in the sector. It was a triumph for Ferranti's technology-led strategy, but it also underlined the fact that if the market had been more responsive some 30 years earlier, the growth of the British electrical industry would have been very much faster. The contrast between the two periods illustrates Sir John Habakkuk's dictum: great generals are not made in time of peace, great entrepreneurs are not made in non-expanding industries. And that was part of an appreciation of Sebastian Ferranti in a book entitled Ferranti and the British Electrical Industry by J.F. Wilson and published by the Manchester University Press.
I'm in love. Sometimes I get so afraid I'll say something so wrong, just to have something to say. I know the moment is right to tell the girl a comical line to keep the conversation. That's how I feel. Then it's the best feeling I've ever known. It's undeniably real. Leave a tender moment alone. Yes, I know I'm in love. But just when I ought to relax, I put my foot in my avoiding the facts. If the girl gets too close,
but that's not how I feel. No, that's not the woman I know. She's undeniably real. So leave a tender moment alone. But it's not only me breaking down when the tension gets high. Just when I'm in a serious mood, she is suddenly quiet and shy. Change the attitude tonight. I'll run out of places to hide. And if that's how I feel, then it's the best healing I've ever known. It's undeniably real. Oh, leave a tender moment alone.
At the recent International Broadcasting Convention held in Brighton, Peter Lindsay of JVC was asked by Henry Doulette about the SVHS editing system on display.
Well, one of the first things that was considered when they were developing SVHS was the need to be able to still handle conventional VHS. So, as you'll see on both these machines, you have the ability to play back and record conventional or standard VHS tapes. The most obvious use of that when someone's bought an SVHS suite is, having done your editing, if you need to, you can make a final copy to give to somebody, a colleague or whatever, in conventional standard VHS format. The machines themselves, as you said, there's a player recorder, which is the source side. You've got an edit machine on the right-hand side here. The main thing about the edit machine is the fact that it's got hi-fi sound on as well as longitudinal sound. Both machines, in fact, have twin longitudinal audio tracks. The controller that controls the two machines is a new unit. Although it looks very similar to the existing RMG 850, this one, the 810, is a parallel controlled output, with the previous one, which is still available, is serial. The reason for that was that a lot of the early JVC machines are parallel controlled.
Yes.
So we've gone for parallel for this. The way this is configured, and it's the way that most people would use it, is that we're coming out of the player in YC form.
So that's the separate luminance and chrominance signal.
Yes, it is indeed, but the chrominance is coming out at 627. In other words, the normal colour under frequency off tape.
Yes.
That you would get from a VHS colour under system. That's going across to the input of the recorder. The monitors, one above each machine, they're also being fed with separate luminance and chrominance. The subtle difference there is that they're being fed with chrominance at 443 subcarrier frequency. The reason for that is that shortly, I'm not sure when, but not that far off, domestic televisions will have this S connector fitted that allows you to feed luminance and chrominance in separately.
Do you see this fitting of the luminance-chrominance sockets as becoming more common on domestic sets?
Well, it's only an opinion and a guess, but I would have said yes, it's bound to happen eventually. How quickly it happens, I suppose, is up to the manufacturers, but yes, I would.
So people will be able to buy an SVHS machine with something like a SCART plug on the back,
mm-hmm.
which is a multi-pin plug and a similar plug on their TV set, and they can plug it together. And
yeah, the plug on the television actually is a specially chosen 4-pin connector that purely carries the luminance and chrominance into the television.
This will allow them to exploit the improved performance, which we see here is really quite remarkable.
Yeah, what you're looking there is second generation. In fact, one actually plays that back, which is therefore a recording of that, you're going to get third generation. And I think you'll find that the difference is remarkably little. I'll just scroll that back a bit. Go back a bit further. There you go. That's now, you're looking there at third generation.
In terms of commercial users, do you see this making large inroads to the low-band U-matic market?
Yes, I do. I think certainly the industrial market will be very attracted to it because of the obvious quality that you're going to get for a reasonable price, and because it is comparable with low-band in price, etc., and potentially longer playing times, smaller recorders for camcorder operation. I think it must eventually have quite an impact on the low-band market.
Fine.
Not that it happen overnight, nothing ever does, but I think that's the way it will go.
Well, it's very interesting. Thank you very much for your comments.
That was Henry Dulat talking to Peter Lindsay of JVC at the International Broadcasting Convention held in Brighton recently.
And now to some letters from Ian Irvin from Lambton Village, Washington, Tyne and Wear in Northern England. Thank you for your letter.
And from Kirby Lonsdale, Carnforth in Lancashire, Bob Cookson wrote that he received a very enjoyable and interesting signal when he listened to Radio Fax recently.
Lately, I have heard your station on 1611 regularly with strong signals, and it seems as your station is not dependent on good propagation to be heard well. This is from Norway. I am 44 years old, and I have been listening to radio stations for several years. In the beginning, I listened to shortwave only, as the domestic receiver I used was not good enough for the medium wave band. 7 years ago, I bought my first communications receiver and then discovered the fascinating medium wave. Here in Hamar, it is difficult to hear interesting stations because of local noise and the fact that I'm not allowed to put up long wires of hundreds of metres. Therefore, I go to my cottage in the forest some miles away, where I spend many weekends. It is a wonderful place for radio listening and recreation. My wife and two kids are not interested in radio, but they love to visit the place because of the quietness, which is obtainable only in the forests. There we have seen elks, hares and roe deers just outside the window, and there are also wolves in the area. From Harry Hogberg from Hamar in Norway.
From Michael Clutton in Woodchurch, Shropshire, a letter which goes, thanks for the interesting programmes. I've been listening to you for about 2 weeks since I was told about your station. Very strong clear signals on 6205 kHz with only slight fading. Keep up the good work. That's from Michael Clutton in Shropshire.
From Ireland, Bill Mayer says, incidentally, your transmission on 1611 nighttime cannot be received here in Ireland. Keep up the good work. By the way, I'm a qualified radio operator since last March and I'm presently job hunting. Any vacancies? That's Bill Mayer from Glenview Square, Tipperary, County Tipperary in Ireland. And I'd hate to contradict one of our listeners, but I've driven all over Ireland doing field strength measurements on radio fax and I know it can be heard in County Tipperary.